House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. As usual, we have a busy day. And we'll start with our good colleague, Representative Huffman. I'm going to open a public hearing on 2105 at 2106. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2105 directs the Oregon Department of Energy to study and report on issues relating to the Energy Facility Setting Council, or EFSEC, by November 1st, 2013. It requires a report to include issues involving enhanced collaboration among state agencies, types of facilities required to obtain EFSEC permits, and enhanced efficiencies in the energy facility setting process. It declares an emergency as it is effective on passage. House Bill 2106 requires the Oregon Department of Energy to create a map identifying areas east of the Cascade Mountain Summit potentially appropriate for siting energy facilities. It lists map requirements, directs the Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop and administer a mitigation bank if any approved energy facilities are identified on the map, requires ODO to study and issue a report to the Legislative Assembly on jurisdiction of Energy Facility Siting Council and role of local governments. It clarifies EFSEC authority to issue site certificate to facility meeting one or more applicable standards if overall public benefit of facility outweighs adverse effects on resource or interests. It directs EFSEC to adopt rules specifying criteria for public benefit determination, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Representative Huffman, would you like to kick us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59. Adam took my testimony, so it's been great being with you today. I appreciate We do appreciate you opening up a hearing on both House Bills 2105 and 2106. Both of the bills, the attempt and the goal is to help us create more predictability and certainty in the state's facility siting process. Did you catch that, Representative Dimbrow?
I did. I appreciate it.
Okay, good. Good. I'll continue now. Both bills are placeholders. We do have some amendments that I think they're out as of yesterday, I believe, and hopefully the committee has those and we can review them. The partners are going to be working together on those. We've had quite the collaborative group working together this past year with Margie and the governor's office to bring these two bills forward. Yeah, Oregon has one of the best facility siting processes in the country. The Energy Siting Council works with state and local permitting processes and brings people together, and it is a good process, but we think that as with most things, you might be able to find a way to improve it, and so that's what we've been working to do. Individual siting decisions often lack broader context of trade-offs among conflicting public policy priorities, and so developers are currently incentivized to develop and mitigate projects one project at a time. And despite best efforts to avoid, reduce, and mitigate for impact under current policies, it's nearly impossible to anticipate the cumulative effect of multiple projects located in the same area. With an overarching energy and conservation framework, requirements for mitigation impacts from development are cumbersome and often ad hoc. They have high transaction costs associated with them, often for developers, uncertainty that mitigation actions will adequately offset environmental impacts. And so we're trying to create a more comprehensive approach and, again, create more predictability and certainty for developers as we move forward and the public in general, giving them the protections that they want and desire. So that's my testimony, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And just trying to tee it up for Margie Hoffman. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative. And I know the Representative has other business, so before we get to Ms. Hoffman, any questions for the Representative?
They wouldn't dare.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Chair Bailey, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I'm Governor John Kitzhaber's energy policy advisor, and just want to say thank you for hearing both of these bills today. As Representative Huffman mentioned, the 2105 and 2106 as they read today, our placeholder bill. So I want to talk through the amendments. I've met with some of you and we'll be meeting with the rest of you, and also we'll be convening a work group on both bills next week. 2105 will be amended to direct the Energy Facility Siting Council, which is the site certificate agency for permitting utility-scale projects, to conduct an audit to look at current practices and procedures and see if there are any ways in which we can improve upon the Energy Facility Siting Council process. That's 2105, very simple. 2106 will be, right now, 2106, there are two components to that. One directs the agencies to develop what's called a landscape level plan, and the second component directs the agencies to develop a mitigation bank. So the amendments to House Bill 2106 will actually take out the landscape level plan. That's something that we need more time to come to consensus about a starting place for the conversation and conceptualize what that looks like. We will continue to move forward on that in the interim and likely bring something back in a future legislative session. But the mitigation banking proposal, the amendments to House Bill 2106 will direct the Oregon Department of Energy and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and other relevant agencies to move forward with developing a mitigation bank for large projects.
Questions?
Not really a question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. I appreciate the use of the terminology about mitigation. I think that's really important to talk about the interaction between the agencies and the folks at the local level. We passed a bill last session that requires ODF&W to consult with counties regarding mitigation about any sort of listing of species and so forth and so on. So I think just the idea that we're requiring a conversation about that is an important thing. So I support what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hoffman, do you want to walk us through it all? Any of the handouts that we have in front of us here?
Oh, they made it.
Yep.
Well, I just explained them very simply, and we will be convening. The process for moving forward is that we'll be reconvening the stakeholders, so members of the utilities and independent power producers and members of the conservation community and agency representatives. We'll meet next week to go over the amendments, and then I'll circle back around with all of you to go through them line by line. I don't think it's necessary to do that here today. And then once we're ready to go and we have consensus on the amendments, we'll come back and hopefully move the bill.
So we just to make sure I'm clear, we have 2105, which is going to become a review and study for how we streamline siting and permitting amongst various levels of government between different agencies. And then we have 2106, which will become primarily a directive around mitigation banking for projects to be able to do mitigation in multiple jurisdictions or across multiple areas. Is that correct?
Chair Bailey, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was thank you for this bill. I have another bill of similar nature on a much narrower scale addressed to mitigation of sage-grouse in or setting up a framework for mitigation of sage-grouse situations so that something can happen in my part of the state, because currently nothing's happening in my part of the state by virtue of the sage-grouse challenge. And so I noticed that in this document here, House Bill 2106, is this the proposed amendment, or is this?
That's the draft proposed amendment. So again, we're going to work with stakeholders and members of the committee, and actually, Representative Benz, Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, you'll be at that meeting as well.
Thank you. Follow up.
Please.
I'm happy, of course, for that invitation that we discussed previously, but I just want to make sure I understand. You're not asking that we do anything with this at this point, except to wait.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, that's correct. Yes.
And one final place. The mitigation concept and the measure of that which we're trying to offset is of such extraordinary importance that it is a great difficulty in addressing it and a huge challenge. But we've got to do something, and what's happened thus far is nothing. So I'm very much looking forward to the conversation and hoping that we can move something through this body, this session, so that we can unlock the potential of my area, because it's currently pretty much not, as primarily as a result of today, the sage-grouse, tomorrow, who knows. So the mitigation's hugely important.
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, thank you for your comments. Look forward to working with you on this.
And I would actually just echo Representative Bentz's comments and say first that I'm very appreciative that the governor's office and all the stakeholders that are involved in this are tackling what is a thorny issue and one that I think has stymied progress on renewable energy development in this state. I too hope that we can get to something that we can pass this session. There is a way for us to plan for and cite renewable energy that moves our state forward in its job creation goals and its climate goals, while at the same time making sure that we're protecting and enhancing our natural environment in which these projects are located. There is a way to do this, I am convinced. And the ad hoc discussions that we've had in the past have led to an impasse and perhaps have been less coordinated than they might have been with a structured process. So your leadership on the structured process, I think, is admirable. I appreciate Representative Huffman working so hard on this, and I think that's indicative of the fact that I don't think this is a partisan issue in any way. This is an issue in which we're all trying to figure out how best to streamline this process to make sure the projects that create jobs get built and do so in the most responsible manner. So, thank you.
Chair Bailey, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
I look forward to working with all of you, and thank you for your time.
Call up Bronner Seaman, Bruce Taylor, and Tom Wolf.
Please. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Varner Seaman, Policy Director at Renewable Northwest Project. I'll keep my comments pretty brief on both HB 2105 and 2106. We support both of these bills, and we look forward to working through the work group process. We think that we do have some, as the comments were just reflecting, some opportunity to both provide some real economic development and to get some projects cited, at the same time do some things which are positive for the species. So I just want to thank again Representative Huffman for his leadership, and also thank the governor's office for the leadership. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Mr. Taylor.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Taylor. I'm with Defenders of Wildlife, and I was part of the task force that made recommendations for the governor's 10-year energy plan and part of the transmission and siting and transmission group there. So Representative Huffman and Margie covered most of what I wanted to just mention because I just wanted to speak in general terms here today, but just a little bit more on the mitigation concept and you know what I think we were envisioning and whether we all agree that we were talking about the same thing, I think remains to be seen. It's a more strategic approach to the way we do mitigation. As Representative Huffman said, it's usually a one-off kind of experience, and we make it up and start over again every time here. So the idea is stepping back, taking a big look at where are the most important places to invest those mitigation resources and do it in a more comprehensive kind of way, try to aggregate mitigation investments in places that will make a larger difference out there. And there are, it has been a fair amount of work already done in other arenas on this. Wetland mitigation banking is one example where the mechanics have been worked out pretty well. Right now in the energy siting field, Portland General Electric has been working with a group on mitigation options for the eastern portion of its Cascade Crossing transmission line project that is attempting to actually apply these concepts that we're talking about, landscape approaches to mitigation. And it looks pretty promising so far here. So I think there's a lot to work with there. And you know there will be a need for the state to establish what the ground rules are, exactly how this process works. But I think there should be room in the future for mitigation banking being a good option to deal with this, whether it's public agencies developing banks or private sector individuals doing that. It's probably a far more efficient way to deal with the issue. Thank you.
Thanks.
Chair Bailey, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. In 2012, the Trout Unlimited science team produced a document on energy siting, and where we basically took a map and looked at all the places that we believe were the best places to site renewable or other energy projects, and came up with basically a procedure that tries to put those energy projects in basically in lands that are already to a certain ground degraded or used and try to keep the more pristine areas protected. Unfortunately, my hard copies of that report, which I'd hoped to give to many of you today, didn't come yet, but I hope to get that to you. And I appreciate what's been done, specifically on HB 2106 and what's being developed there. But I'd really encourage, and I understand that placement of energy is very important to many people in Eastern Oregon and stuff, but it's also how we do this in the future. And it's always been a mantra of mine is we can't shortchange the future by blindly going forth in the short term. So I just ask that as the Department of Energy and others proceed down there, that we use a modicum of restraint and caution, because you know, as my grandfather, who started in 1910 and basically cut down all the old growth across the strait, not him personally, but his generation, they thought it would never end. And we have to be careful about how we place those future renewable energy or energy sites, and how, and all the mitigation we use. And so I just urge some caution, but I'm encouraged by the route that seems to be going. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward with anticipation to the conversation. I think it's important that there be point counterpoint. So I'm going to engage in that for a moment. And I would just say that in the last 10 years, Oregon's per capita income has increased $1 over inflation. In the last 10 years, Oregon's per capita income has increased $1 over inflation. Now, we certainly can't blame that on the environment, but we need to do something. And so I'm sure working together, we can.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for your comments. Seeing no one else who wishes to testify on this. Oh, we got one more. Bill?
Chair Bailey, committee for the record, Bill Cluny, Partners, Joiners of America. We're doing the right steps here. We're putting together a plan to figure out where we can do something. We can't create a job until the site has been picked, it's been okayed. The way we've done it in the past, somebody comes in and wants to do something over here, there's five agencies move in and say no. This is a good step forward. Let the experts do their work. Let's get the sites pinpointed, especially I like the part about rural Oregon. East of the Cascades. These are two good bills. Let the experts do their work. Let's put it on the map. Then let the people come in to create the jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cluny. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2105 and 2106 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2860. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2860 exempts diesel fuel sold to hospital facilities and long-term care facilities from the requirement to contain a certain percentage of biodiesel or with a specific percentage of renewable component. We also have a dash one amendment for this. It adds the broadcasting stations to the class of exempt facilities.
I'll call up Roger Cole and Andy Easton, please.
Chair Bailey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roger Cole. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University in support of House Bill 2860. House Bill 2860 would provide an exemption for hospitals and long-term care facilities from the state standard that requires fuels to contain 5% biodiesel. As many of you know, Oregon's renewable fuel standard requires that all diesel fuel sold or offered for sale in Oregon must contain a minimum of 5% biodiesel by volume. Because hospitals and long-term care facilities need to maintain 24-hour service availability for patient care, these facilities store large amounts of emergency fuel to be used in emergency generators in case of a prolonged power outage. The challenge for hospitals and long-term care providers is that biofuels have a limited shelf life, even in optimum conditions. The industry standard for maximum storage time of biofuels is 6 months. The fuel can stratify in longer-term storage and attract water, causing microbial growth. The growth can contaminate the fuel, causing the risk for malfunction of our emergency diesel generators or boilers. OHSU currently stores over 100,000 gallons of fuel to support emergency generators for power outages and as backup fuel supply for steam boilers that provide heat to our campus. Emergency fuel supplies and generator tanks are never totally consumed. They are maintained to be always at the ready to support patient care and research functions in emergency situations. The fuel supply may take years to be completely replaced. Currently, there are exemptions in statute for 1, railroad locomotives, 2, marine engines, and 3, home heating applications. By including the exception of emergency fuel storage for hospitals and long-term care facilities into the renewable fuel standard, we reduce the serious risk of failure of emergency equipment and loss of power to critical patient care services. I encourage your support for this important legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
I'm Andy Easton with the Oregon Hospital Association. Chair Bailey and co-chairs Boone and Johnson, thank you for having this bill in front of you today. I just want to assure the audience and the panel here that I am not lost or confused with the House Healthcare Committee, but we are very much in support of House Bill 2860. Again, this bill would exempt hospitals from requiring to have biofuels for a backup storage. Hospitals must not only be prepared for the emergency patients that come into our emergency rooms, but also be prepared for emergency events that happen outside of our walls that contain or impact the ability for us to deliver care. Having backup generators is required for us. We are, in average, required to have about 96 hours of fuel time in our storages. We don't always use that. We live in the Great Northwest, where we don't have the same natural disasters that our partners do across the country. So we rarely have these power outages that require 96 hours of fuel. But when they do, we need to be prepared. And so we are asking that hospitals be exempt for those hospitals who do not have the converters already, who have not converted over to biofuels, but for those who have converted to biofuels, we'd like for them to be able to continue to use them too.
I have a couple questions. Have you used your generators in the last 6 months?
Yeah, we have regular preventative maintenance that we maintain them. So, yes, we have.
Have you seen any evidence of separation or problems?
We haven't had any difficulties to date. However, as we've indicated, we're not replenishing the entire tank, so there's only a very small amount of biofuels there.
Got it. And what brought this bill up now, out of curiosity?
I think it's out of concern of the risk of being able to supply emergency power to the hospitals and inpatient care facilities.
But given that the mandate has been in place for several sessions, I'm curious what precipitated the conversation this session.
Right. No, it's a good question. I think we've been kind of watching it to see if there are any issues, and just to see exactly how to approach it. We weren't really sure how to approach the issue, so it's kind of come to fruition now.
And sorry, before we get to other questions, I just want to make sure that I understand correctly that the issue that you're describing is with stratification of the fuel over time from long-term storage, this, mm-hmm. even under ideal conditions. This is not an issue of temperature. Is that correct?
It is. It is the contamination of the fuel over time and the long-term storage.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I might be able to answer your question for you. this is coming up, I think, because of the House Resolution 3's statewide resilience plan. One of the recommendations is just that, having this available fuel, fueled devices to handle emergencies for long term. And I hate to put a damper on it, but I don't think 96 hours is going to do the trick. But in any case, the fact that you have 100,000 gallons of fuel at the ready, that is what's important, and it's important for them to be able to count on that fuel being ready to use, and that it's not going to foul the generators or whatever, because it would be prohibitive cost-wise to have to replace it at whatever the regular intervals are. And this plan is, you guys in Portland are going to be inundated with people from the coast if we can get over there, and the hospitals are no way going to be prepared for the onslaught of all the people who will need their care. So anything we can do to help enable them to be ready for what they can handle is going to be paramount. And so this plan will be revealed next 2 weeks, March 14th, in a joint committee for the Senate and House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committees, and the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council that was tasked with doing the plan utilized 150 volunteers to create this plan from eight sectors. And a lot of the things, it says tsunami, earthquake, that's not all coastal. Portland's going to have a big, big impact too. So hospitals, we know, are, they do all they can now, but for the numbers that we're hearing potential, it's going to be a challenge for everyone. And so there's just, I think this is great that we're doing this right now to help set the stage. And this is part of it. When this plan reveals the recommendation lists, it's a 300-page report. So it's got a lot of ideas in there for you. But
thank you, Representative. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this brings up an issue we've had discussions on in the past. Mm-hmm. But if are there tests that indicate the stratification? Because if the hospitals have the problem, then there's anything that would need fuel on an emergency basis stores it. And for example, server farms that have backup diesel generation systems store a lot of fuel on site, and they might come in, and then another, and then another, and then another. So the issue is the studies. So do you have them that show the stratification? I mean, is this something that will happen or can be proven to happen? And as a add-on, I went through this with the fuel jobbers in Ontario, who then put together a blending plant, a blending facility, and now supply blended fuel diesel to most of Eastern Oregon. And so we went through some incredible chemical analyses to reach a point to hopefully not have this problem. And I say hopefully because they're selling it on the grounds that it wouldn't. But that's my question, because if we passed your bill, there's going to be a big long line out there asking for every emergency tank to have this out.
Sure.
Do you know studies?
So I can't cite specific studies. I know we have talked with other institutions about this, and there is a similar concern out there about the biofuels, and it's across the nation.
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, we will find those studies for you.
In addition to studies, it would be interesting to see if there's been any actual incidences at hospitals that you can report that whether a gelling has taken place in a backup generator.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just following along the same lines, are there other states that have this kind of exemption for hospital or long-term care facilities? Do you know? I mean, are we unique in having this requirement to begin with? But the states that have similar requirements, have they given exemptions for, for generators in this way?
Yeah. Have you heard of any? I have. I'm not familiar with any.
That would be useful to know.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, tell me where the 96 hours comes from. Is that some commonly held standard out there?
It is. So, Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, hospitals are heavily regulated, not only for patient safety issues and not only for the provisions of healthcare, but also for the emergency need for backup equipment. And under the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, they have a code there in their in their regulations that stipulates that hospitals, depending on their bed size, how many beds they have in their facilities, and depending on the geographic risk factors, they're required to have anywhere from 24 to 96 hours. Okay. Most of Oregon's hospitals have around 96 hours.
It really seems like many ways directly connected with our whole disaster preparedness network across the state, as we talk about investing a lot of time and resources in earthquake-proofing buildings and in tsunami awareness facility, you know, that network of letting people know when there's a public emergency. But also, you guys are obviously going to be the critical care providers, and it only makes sense to make sure that you're open and available and ready to provide whatever care is necessary. So it seems like a really logical progression to me to ensure that there's no guessing about when you flip the on switch of that diesel generator, whether it's going to work or not.
Mm-hmm. Representative Booth?
Maybe this is a, thank you, Mr. Chair, maybe it's a question for you, because this is kind of in your area. Do you know if there is any research being done to look into, you know, how we can improve the quality of the fuel so that it doesn't cause these situations?
That may be a longer conversation for another day, Representative, and I can tell you that biodiesel is of extremely high quality and goes through rigorous ASTM testing, and I think the issue of the quality of the fuel is not really at discussion here. It's talking about long-term storage.
Yeah, that's what I mean, but looking at...
We can follow up on that. Okay. Representative Widener. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just gone through, and I'm just reading one of the recent testing surveys by the ASTM have indicated significant percentage of commercial biodiesel did not meet ASTM D6751 specifications. Primary concerns were excessive glycerin content and biodiesel stability when stored over time with degradation. So, and that's off the ASTM tests that were.
Do you have a question for the panel, Representative?
So, I'm just wondering for the panel and just what I've heard here, because you were saying it meets it. Is this something where lots of hospitals or emergency people have come and said, hey, this is something we're really concerned about? And are your storage tanks in ground, above ground, are they outside or inside?
All the above.
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, we have heard from both hospitals who have asked for this exemption because they have older facilities that have not been revisited lately, or they have not had any upgrades to them. And we've heard from others who have brand new facilities, brand new towers, who have all made modifications for biofuels. So we, as a hospital, as a state, out of the 58 hospitals we have across the state, we're in a 50-50 kind of boat right now.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Please.
If something was to happen and those diesel generators didn't come on, who would be liable? Would it be the hospital or would it be the state for the mandate?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, I would have to get back to you on that one. Ultimately, hospital will be responsible for that life that they couldn't save.
Representative
Whitsitt. Is there an amendment to this proposed by radio stations?
There is. We have a dash one amendment, I believe, that would include broadcasters in this.
Okay, so we're kind of looking at what Rep. Bence was suggesting. Perhaps we start adding a list of everybody who's an emergency responder in some capacity wanting an exemption from it. I mean, it's more of a question statement there.
I think there has been a discussion about what other types of long-term storage for emergency generation do we include. Representative Dembo, do you have a question?
No, I don't. Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call up Dan Jarman, Debbie Rotich, and Roger Dominguez, please.
The line is for me.
Get
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. I'm Dan Jarman, here today representing Oregon Public Broadcasting. We are not here today to give you a season 4 premiere of Downton Abbey, just so you know.
You're dismissed.
But we are here to talk about this very important issue, and we certainly support this bill and want to thank OHSU, you, Chair Bailey, and others for allowing us to discuss an important amendment, we think, to this bill that it does address the long-term storage issue. So I'd like to turn the mic over to Debbie Rotich, who is with OPB, Vice President of Administration, to discuss our amendment. Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Rotich. I am the Vice President of Administration at OPB. Our President, Steve Bass, is very sorry he cannot be here today to testify, so I'm here in his stead. I oversee OPB's facilities and its broadcast engineering functions, although I am not a technical expert. However, today Roger Dominguez, our Director of Network Engineering, is with me, and he can answer any technical OPB questions you may have. OPB is a nonprofit organization that operates Oregon's most extensive network of public television and radio stations. From our headquarters in Portland, we operate 5 television stations based in Portland, Corvallis, Bend, Eugene, and LeGrand, and we have 41 related television translators that serve rural communities. Our radio network consists of 16 radio stations serving much of the same area, and they have an emphasis on news and information. Until 1993, OPB was a state agency, and we received a considerable amount of our funding from the state. Today, OPB is an independent, nonprofit organization that receives no operating funding from the state of Oregon. However, OPB continues to play what we consider to be a significant public service role for both the state and its citizens. One of the voluntary responsibilities that OPB has carried over from its days as a state agency is serving as the state primary station, the only activation point for the emergency alert system in Oregon. In the event of a statewide, regional, or national emergency, OPB would initiate messages informing all other broadcasters, commercial and non-commercial, viewers and listeners of a wide variety of emergencies, including amber alerts, tsunamis, wildfires, floods, earthquakes. OPB and other public broadcasters provide vital coverage during times of emergency. And while we've been fortunate in Oregon to not experience that, we all probably recall what happened with Hurricane Sandy, with the millions in New York metropolitan area when they were without power, and New Jersey. Cell phone networks, cable television, and internet services were disrupted. And if it was not for the public broadcasting station, WNYC, which maintained their critical broadcasts on emergency conditions during that time, people would have been without more than just electricity. They would have been in the dark about the severity of the storm, where to seek help, seek shelter, or what was the state of the recovery efforts. So this experience with Hurricane Sandy, and certainly earlier with Katrina, indicates that probably one of the most reliable forms of information during these kinds of emergencies is good old-fashioned radio. So most people have AM and FM radios in their cars, and they can be run, of course, by battery power. And many people have crank radios in their emergency supplies. Were Oregon to experience a major earthquake, radio would likely be a key lifeline. And in order to play that critical role, if that time comes, OPB must have a 100% reliable source of backup power, particularly at our headquarters facility in Portland on Macadam Avenue. Everything for the emergency alert system links through that main building, and if power is lost and our primary generator is unable to function for any reason, then the rest of the state would be affected. So again, it's imperative at that one critical moment, hopefully only one, when our emergency generator is needed, that it will start and it will maintain continuous service for hours or even days if necessary. We respectfully ask this committee to amend House Bill 2860 with a provision that allows an exemption from biodiesel requirements for broadcasters that use generators for emergency communications. Our request is contained in the -1 amendment. We thank Chair Bailey, Representative Tim Freeman, and Oregon Health and Sciences University for working with us on this issue and for supporting this friendly amendment. This important exemption will increase the odds that when the state and its citizens need OPB, we will be there for them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we are happy, or I should say Roger is, happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Dominguez, I'm curious if you could answer, how often do you use these emergency backup generators?
We usually do have them on a regular exercise function. So typically they'll come on once a week. Weekly we'll run them. But you know, as far as emergency use, I'm thinking probably once or twice a year.
Got it.
Yeah.
And Chair Bailey, this is Dan Jarman. And when they turn it on weekly, that's just for testing. They're required to testing. FEMA requires them to do it. So it's not anything that's ongoing. It may just be a very, very short period of time.
Sure. I'm just curious. I just looked it up, and according to British Petroleum, regular unalterated diesel fuel without any renewable diesel content in it will degrade and become unusable after about a year under normal circumstances, and in as few as 6 months with it's stored at any kind of temperatures that are warm. So I'm curious, given that it's a longer storage period, a longer period in between the time that you need these backup generators, are you seeing any problems with regular diesel, and why do you think this bill would help?
No, we really haven't seen any.
And I'm sorry, can you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. Roger, my name is Roger Dominguez. I'm the Director of Network Services for Oregon Public Broadcasting. And Chair Bailey, no, you know, we really haven't seen any issues. Of course, we do have our fuel tested periodically. And yeah, no, at this point, we haven't really seen any issues with the fuel systems.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have filter systems after your tanks when it comes out and everything for water separation for the long periods of time where you have that storage and then filters for taking out particles?
That is, Chair Bailey and Representative Widener, that is correct. We do have filter systems that do separate the water out of the diesel fuel.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2860. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2938. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2938 declares a policy of reduction of environmental waste for rechargeable batteries, provides definition of rechargeable battery, battery manufacturer, retailer, and consumer, bans disposal of rechargeable batteries as solid waste, provides guidelines for rechargeable battery recycling program, including signage, return locations, collection responsibilities, and reporting requirements. It outlines fines and penalties for retailers and consumers if knowingly violating the ban on disposal of or program requirements. It allows the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules as necessary to implement the program, and it becomes operative on July 1st, 2014.
Okay, I'd like to call forward Carl Smith, Scott Clagg, and Palmer Mason, please. And Mr. Smith, if you'd kick us off, please.
Thank you, Chairman Bailey. And thank you to the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 2938, I should say dash one. Unfortunately, none of us have that dash one yet. It's a complete stuff and amendments. So I will be speaking largely based upon what I anticipate dash one to be. So unfortunately, you don't have it in front of you. So again, my apologies. My name is Carl Smith, and I'm CEO and president of Call to Recycle. In the early 1990s, five manufacturers, including Energizer, Panasonic, and Sanyo, decided to create an industry-run, voluntary nationwide program that would seek to keep cadmium, a heavy metal prevalent in the most common rechargeable batteries of that period, out of municipal landfills. The industry was convinced then, as it is today, that it's best prepared and, in fact, obligated to ensure the proper end-of-life disposal of rechargeable batteries. I head that program, which is today called Call to Recycle, a nonprofit which collected over 10 million pounds of batteries in 2012 and has collected over 775,000 pounds in the state of Oregon since formal records were kept in 1999. We collect batteries from 434 sites throughout the state, Metro Portland, Marion, and Lane counties, amongst others. Count on us to support them and defray their costs of collection. Retailers committed to sustainability like Best Buy, Lowe's, The Home Depot, and Staples consider us their partner in their efforts. Kaiser Permanente, Nike, Oregon State University welcome our program as part of their overall environmental agendas. And almost everywhere in the U.S., the program is still purely voluntary and has grown exponentially, with over 200 manufacturers now supporting it. However, the dynamics of the battery and electronics market has fundamentally changed since the early 90s. It's now a global market, and more products are battery-operated. While corporate sustainability role models like Sony, HP, Apple, Samsung, Black & Decker, Columbia Sportswear, Microsoft, and Dell are staunch supporters of our voluntary program and pay us to collect their batteries, more and more products entering the U.S. market are not. In fact, our recent audit indicates that as much as 40% by weight of our battery waste stream are manufactured by companies that are not participating in the program. In fact, 4 years ago, Senator Dingfelder on the Senate side introduced a similar bill that you see in front of you, and we came out and testified against it because we told her, as we believed at the time, it wasn't necessary. Only 10% of our waste stream at that time were these so-called free riders. It's increased, obviously, four times since that, mere 4 years ago. While we fervently believe in industry policing itself, we don't believe that a voluntary program like ours can be sustained long-term without some assistance from states in ensuring a level playing field and assisting us in pursuing these free riders. In essence, we've sought a bill, the bill before this committee, that will allow us to seek assistance from state on this issue in return for having plans like ours overseen and monitored. For some of the battery and electronic businesses who support us, it's pursuing a deal akin to doing a deal with the devil, because they generally don't stick up their hand and say, I want to be regulated by a state. But it's also a move all of us know we have to make to ensure not only our organization's survival, but to avoid what assuredly would be a much more prescriptive approach that people would have to implement to ensure that these batteries are handled appropriately. So you ask, who are these free riders? Most of them are not well-known brands. Many of them are brands made in Asia. They make toys, uninterrupted power supplies, rechargers, personal care products, and computer accessories. They're often manufactured by one company, branded by another, distributed by yet another company, and sold by a retailer in the state. The bill would work as follows. It requires that all parties that put rechargeable batteries into the marketplace to participate in the qualified program. Groups of obligated manufacturers would submit plans to the state on how they would manage it. The state would ensure the plans address a wide range of issues, including accessibility to consumers and public education. While the state ultimately oversees the program, the bill is intended to empower industry to self-regulate participation and compliance. No organization, including retailers, is obligated to collect batteries. The only substantive obligation placed on retailers is that there may ultimately be a no-sell list generated by the state of products that refuse, despite persistent urging, to participate in an approved plan. Any organization wants to collect batteries can do so and does not have to seek state approval. The bill is not intended to impact those out there who just want to collect. The focus is on ensuring that those who put the batteries into the marketplace are financing proper disposal. Similar bills are under consideration in the states of Washington, California, and Minnesota. The bill has passed the responsible House committees in Washington and is awaiting Senate approval. All the counties and cities in Washington have supported the bill. Several business interests, including the haulers, waste management, Republic Services, are actively sponsoring that bill, too. We expect it to be heard on the House floor in the next week or two and are getting increasingly confident of its approval. Hearings are scheduled in the next few weeks in California and on the 5th in Minnesota. We've worked with a myriad of groups in these states over the last year or so to amend the bill, clarify issues, and to make it workable for all involved. And we're committed to continue to work with whomever has any concerns over this bill. We have yet to receive a lot of feedback from the Department of Environmental Quality to understand any concerns they would have or their cost of administration. Obviously, we know that that's important, but we don't think cost should be a significant issue because, you know, there's a program and a mechanism that already exists. Manufacturers are already committed to doing this. You don't have to convince us to do anything about this issue. And we're actually very interested in policing ourselves. We've got the incentive to police ourselves. We think our program and our willingness to step forward separates us from other industry groups. Thanks for your consideration. If I had the bill, I'd be glad to take you through section by section. But in the absence of that, I'm also more than happy to answer any questions you might have about this initiative generally or what we intend the bill to achieve.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. You mentioned you've collected over 700,000 pounds of batteries over the lifetime that you've been doing this. What percentage of the battery itself actually contains the cadmium, nickel, lead, et cetera, of that 700,000 pounds?
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, it will vary tremendously by battery type. It will vary tremendously by year. For instance, a nickel metal hydride will do an assay and 27% this year will be nickel. A couple years ago, it might have only been 25%. So it varies over the board. I mean, I can be glad to provide the committee with much, much more specifics by battery type, but they tend to be averages. They'll change from brand to brand because not everybody does their batteries exactly the same. And plus something like lithium ion, there's probably dozens of different chemical compositions too. So there's no one singular answer.
Would you say generally it's less than 50% of the total gross weight of the battery that is in the heavy metal then, or 25% in general?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, except for the small sealed lead acid batteries, and those are considerably more than the 50%.
Okay. Representative Denbrook.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about just the demarcation between the good stewards and the, you know, those that you call the free riders. Are there any patterns there in terms of manufacturers who fall into one group or the other? Do domestic manufacturers tend to be better stewards than those that are importing or such patterns?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Dembro, generally speaking, the ones that have and care about their brand name are very, very good stewards. So names that you know and recognize, HP, Sony, I mean, they're stellar. I could give you names of the battery guys who aren't, and you will never have heard of them. Most of those batteries are actually manufactured overseas. They're not manufactured in the U.S. And they're branded a different brand based on than the manufacturing company. So none of the ones that you know of are what we're talking about here.
Thank you. That helps.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you for coming in. It's really an important effort that we're making to recover these materials. Can you tell me how successfully, what percentage of batteries we actually recover?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Reardon, that's a very tough question with rechargeable batteries because if you're like me and not very handy with the tool, I still have this my battery-powered screwdriver for 25 years ago, and it has the same original nickel-cadmium battery in it. But if you tried to calculate it based on what ratio of being sold into the market is actually being recycled in that very same year, the best estimates we can come up with is about 10 to 12%. Generally speaking, you have a much higher percentage of single-use batteries are being recycled simply because they tend to last a lot shorter and they're much more disposable and they don't tend to get sold with the product itself. The other thing with rechargeable batteries is they typically are sold with the product and are often disposed with that product too.
One follow-up, please. Have you looked at ways to incent people to return the batteries?
Oh, yes. Representative Bailey, Representative Reardon, yes. We've done a handful of the things that we've done. We've worked with the major power tool companies and with the big box stores like the Home Depot and Lowe's, where they have had trade-ins, where we've given them incentive. If you bring back one of these with the battery, we'll give you 10% off your next tool. We've done a number of incentives in Ontario, not Oregon, but in Ontario. We've actually given a bounty for those who bring in a certain amount of batteries to see if that would incent some behavior. Typically, the bounty has not worked well. It's been more the incentive to purchase or give a discount for a replacement product, not a replacement battery. But it's still very, very difficult. There is not a mindset or culture to recycle like is, for instance, in the European Union.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of going through, trying to wrap my head around this because it's pretty encompassing, and I'm thinking of all the different things that take batteries nowadays.
Yes,
cell
sir.
Phones. I mean, I have old cell phones that still have the battery sitting them in my drawer. I have old laptops because there's information I want off the hard drive, and I can't get rid of the battery because I can't power it up without that battery in there, even though the battery's no good anymore to plug it in to make it work. So I'm not going to be turning those batteries in. So as long as I have information on the hard drive I need. But I'm looking at page 3, line 26, a retailer that sells rechargeable batteries through catalogs or by mail, telephone, or the internet must provide at the time of purchase or delivery to a consumer notice of an opportunity to return used rechargeable batteries for recycling at no cost to the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I got a laptop I buy over the internet from some company that's out of business now, mm-hmm. which I do have a laptop like this. What would they have to provide me since I bought this over the internet? Are they giving me a credit? Are they sending me a coupon that I lose after 20 years? How does that work?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Widener, how that would work, it's at the point of sale, and at the point of sale, folks like Dell, for instance, which sells quite a bit over the internet and is a supporter of our program, will give you...
I'm talking about the company that's out of business.
Those are the Dell. Orphan companies. Unfortunately, you can't obligate them if they don't exist anymore, is the issue. What we try to do is publicize through our own website and through other mechanisms like retailers how people can get rid of those for free, and our program has always been free to consumers and retailers and anybody else. And so if you go in any Home Depot or Best Buy or anything, those come to us, and that's the only way we know to handle it, because there's no way to track down an extinct, if you will, purveyor of laptops or computers.
Let's go through follow-up. Dell would send then a voucher, or how would they handle that?
Well, if you go to Dell's website, Chairman Bailey, Representative Widener, if you go to Dell's website, you will likely see our link or our logo, and it will tell you where you need to go to drop that off for free. Dell itself will also encourage you to take the whole laptop to Goodwill, where they have a network of Goodwill facilities that will gladly take their branded laptops, and they have paid Goodwill to take the battery and the laptops from you. I don't think they offer a coupon or any other type of physical incentive, but they've created a vast network of very successful Goodwill organizations to take that back from you. But they typically don't send you know, the U.S. Postal Service doesn't like to send batteries via mail. They tend to go boom, and they discourage that.
I may follow up
quickly.
So the company would just, like a cell phone company or Dell or whatever, would just have to say then, if I'm understanding this correct, return your laptop or your battery to Goodwill, and that would suffice?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Widener, if they would have a link that says go here to find the drop-off location closest to you. And if it was a battery, it would most likely be one of our locations, because we have a locator of 70,000 different sites on our website throughout North America. If it was a laptop, it would likely be a Goodwill location, because we don't take laptops, but Goodwill does take the entire laptop. We've collected 300,000 phones last year, so if it was a cell phone, even if it was not just the battery, it most likely would direct you to one of our locations.
Thank you. We have two more folks. Is this from Mr. Scott or?
I can wait.
Okay, let's get through our other two panelists, and then we can come back to questions for the whole panel. Mr. Clegg.
Want me to go?
For the record, if you lean back just a little bit from it, it won't distort.
My name is Scott Clegg. I'm a senior solid waste planner. I work for Metro Regional Government. I'm Chair Bailey and members of the committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today about establishing and support of this product stewardship legislation for rechargeable batteries. We offer our testimony today in support of what we understand is going to come of the conversations between the DEQ and Call to Recycle. That's the amended bill that we're supporting. As you are probably aware, Metro is a regional government in the Portland metropolitan area. We serve about 1.5 million residents, and one of the responsibilities we have is managing the solid waste system in the region. And in conjunction with that, we do collect a lot of household hazardous waste. We have over 50,000 customers a year, and one of the things we do take from folks, we are a drop site for batteries. Metro's been a long, strong supporter of product stewardship programs, statewide product stewardship programs. We were an early and strong advocate for initiatives related to e-waste, electronics. One of the things is that the Goodwill that Carl referred to is in fact part of the Oregon eCycles program, so it takes not only the batteries but the electronics through that program. As I said, the program at our facilities, we've been a long participant in the basic Call to Recycle, the RBRC programs that used to be called, where customers bring in batteries and then we send them to Call to Recycle at no cost. Recently, the Call to Recycle has set up a new contractual relationship that we have. It's called the Green Vantage Program, and we now actually get additional compensation to pay for our labor and the drums that we put the batteries and send off. So we're getting about $3,500 a year, and we send about 8,000 pounds of batteries to the Call to Recycle programs every year. Now, these are the batteries that come into our hazardous waste collection days as well as our permanent facilities. And in addition, I understand there are many dozens of sites. I think 80 is probably the right number for the metropolitan area, at least 80 different places. So in addition to what we get, there's these, you know, 80 sites around the Portland metro region, stores and different places that work with Call to Recycle's program. So we're supporting this bill because we want to see these services continue. We are concerned that the free rider problem puts the program at risk for the long term in terms of the financing. We think that in terms of product stewardship programs that we've supported, having a level playing field between all the manufacturers is an extremely important aspect to these programs. And I'd just like to conclude by saying that as Carl mentioned, Call to Recycle came to local governments and talked to folks over a period of many months about the bill, trying to explain what it was trying to do. And we worked, and I think in talking and clarifying what they were trying to do, and came up with some better language for stuff. And so we're very, very pleased that they've been so open in trying to work out any concerns that local governments had had. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Mr. Mason.
For the record, my name is Palmer Mason, the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to talk about House Bill 2938. We don't have a position on the bill. It's as Mr. Smith indicated, we haven't actually seen the final language, so we're waiting to see that before we take a position on the bill. I would say that Call to Recycle and their lobbyist has met with us, and Call to Recycle has a history of working well with the states and the local governments, as Mr. Clagg indicated, on legislation, so we're hopeful we can have productive conversations. I would say, even though we're not taking a position on this bill, that generally the department is supportive of more recovery of materials and less disposal, and this bill is potentially an opportunity to work around that framework, and so we'd like to be very much a part of that conversation. And also Call to Recycle, as Mr. Smith indicated, is a voluntary program, and I do have to tell you, it's been the most successful voluntary program in the world of product stewardship that we've seen, but our experience tells us you do reach a point with voluntary programs in terms of driving higher collections and getting more recovery, and that is, I think, the big reason, as he indicated, why he's here in front of this committee to talk about whether a mandatory approach would actually generate higher collections and result in more recovery. I understand with batteries that we're talking about a subject, while it may seem simple on the surface, rechargeable batteries are ubiquitous. They're in a lot of products, so there are issues that have to be worked through. I appreciate the difficulties that might present retailers and consumers. But I would say generally more recovery is a laudable goal, and we'd like to be a part of any effort to do that and look forward to future conversations on the bill.
Questions for this panel? Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for DEQ. This bill identifies you all as the enforcer of these penalties, and we're talking about civil penalties for persons, retailers, manufacturers, and so forth. Is that something that DEQ is set up to be able to do, to know a $50 offense from a $100 offense from a $2,000 offense, and keeping records and, you know, so forth and so on? Are you watching landfills to ensure that someone doesn't inadvertently slide a used Makita battery in with their whatever? I mean, how would that all play out practically?
So, Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, those are excellent questions. We do have a track record with working with those issues, but they're not simple issues, as your questions indicate. Both in the e-cycles program, which manages the e-waste that comes into the state, as well as the paint program, there's language around these issues. And the best example is probably the e-waste, so I'll focus on that. As you all know, or some on the committee do, the paint program is an evolving program. The e-cycles program, though, does have penalties for retailers who don't inform the consumer at time of sale about the product and their opportunities to recycle. There is language in the e-waste statute around violations for improper disposal and that kind of thing. But that's a good situation to maybe expound upon a little bit more. What the e-waste law did, because even a computer in a ton of trash wouldn't be easy to find, and a battery is even harder, recognize that we shouldn't make the owners and operators of solid waste facilities entirely responsible for what consumers put in the trash that goes out the door and they take it to the curb or wherever they take it. So there's language in that statute that says there's a presumption that if the owner and operator of a solid waste facility has a plan to notify consumers that you shouldn't put these products in the solid waste stream, the presumption is they're complying with the intent of keeping it out of the waste. That may be some language that we want to talk about around rechargeable batteries, because I think rechargeable batteries are even harder than laptops to manage. So I think those are the kind of conversations we want to have. But we do have a track record of working with managing waste in this way, including even the penalty and violations portion.
My question's a follow-up. Section 6 says there's a civil penalty for violating Section 3, and Section 3 states a person may not knowingly dispose of rechargeable batteries. So we have several million persons in Oregon, and first of all, it doesn't describe the size of the battery, this big, this big. And how are we going to look through the garbage of several million people, and that includes children, you know, the whole thing there. So this seems like a very, very broad sort of...
Chair Bailey, brush. Representative Whitsitt, you're looking at the 2938 placeholder. The bill that is the dash one, number one, doesn't have a disposal ban.
That we don't have, right.
Yeah, that you do not have.
Right, okay.
Number two is it's very explicit on what constitutes a battery. It's 11 pounds or less. It's not a motive battery. It has to be a battery that's accessible to a consumer. So, for instance, my iPhone, since you can't get the battery out, you're not obligated to actually get that battery out and to put it in the waste stream. So there's some very specific language that goes well beyond the version that you have in front of you.
When can we expect that? It's difficult to address this without seeing the bill that we're talking about.
Representative, your guess is as good as ours. Legislative Council is working extremely hard on a number of amendment requests.
Thank you, Chair. How do you distribute the cost of the program amongst the manufacturers? Because you have manufacturers of all different sizes. I know you're trying to encourage more people to participate, but if I'm selling 3 batteries a year versus 30 million of them, How do you deal with that difference?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, the way we've set up our pricing scheme is it's based on sales into a marketplace, and it's based on weight. Units is irrelevant as far as this is concerned because the costs that we incurred is associated with the weight, whether it be in transport, in sorting, in processing. So it's essentially 1 cent per 100 grams is the pricing structure based on what's sold into the marketplace. And each company has an annual cap, and this is a North American rate of $175,000 per year. This is all on our website, by the way. It's all public information for anybody who wants to see any of this. So it's a penny per 100 grams.
One follow-up. Where do you collect that information? I mean, on the sales? How do you know where
Chairman Bailey, Representative Reardon, that is self-reported by those. Remember, we're a voluntary program. We ask that those who participate in our program quarterly report to us what are their applicable sales, which they do typically, not all, but do, and then they send us a check. We typically don't even invoice. We are just sent a check quarterly based upon their reported sales.
Okay. Thank you.
That's how great voluntary programs can be.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Reardon kind of was going where I was at on this, and those are pretty big numbers that we are hearing there. And we're going from a voluntary program to the state mandating this. So this is a potential win. Well, Oregon's only 3% of the industrial population, but this is a huge benefit if we implement it in the state for your company, would it not be?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Widener, it certainly would be a benefit to our organization. I would hesitate to call it a windfall. First, we're set up as a not-for-profit, and based upon the current cost line that we're seeing and our reserves, about 7 or 8 years from now, we expect to be out of business. So we look at a bill like this and the few other states that were promoting it as a way to sustain our finances and have not yet envisioned a windfall.
Thank you very much. Appreciate this panel. Call up Jim Craven, please.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Jim Craven on behalf of Tech America. Tech America is a national trade association representing the high-tech industry. We have about 1,000 member companies around the United States who participate. I want to say at the beginning that many of our companies are participants, as Mr. Smith pointed out, are participants, voluntary participants in a call to recycle. And I think they do a great job, and that's why our companies continue to support the fine organization. I think We're all at a little bit of a deficit here of not having the actual bill in front of us. There is a bill in Washington State that we do have in front of us that we've looked at. I don't want to go through that bill because you're at a disadvantage, and so am I, because we're not sure what will come out of legislative council. So I just want to raise a couple of comments and cautions as this debate moves forward that have come up in the Washington State debate from some of our member companies. I think you've hit a number of those here today already. The role of this legislature in moving a voluntary program, a fine voluntary program, into a compulsory program. I think that's a major policy decision that you should think hard about. The way we think the bill will come out is that it doesn't say you have to become a member of this one organization. You can do your own thing, but the terms and conditions of doing your own thing, of setting up a statewide battery recycling operation by company or by a consortium of companies, will be a pretty high bar. And I think what you're hearing is that this is that bar will be high enough that pretty much the default will be compulsory membership. So I think that's something we all need to wrestle with and think hard about. There's also some provisions up in Washington State that would allow this organization to initiate civil lawsuits against non-compliers. Again, that's a pretty big policy step to think about. Compelling membership in an organization, then you granting that organization the right to do civil lawsuits against people who don't join the organization. So it's kind of novel and something that's I'm not aware of that we do in other realms. I think effective recycling always comes down, as one of you mentioned, to the consumer doing the right thing. You can compel companies to join an organization. You can lead a horse to water, etc. But I still think maybe the focus has to be at the end of the day to get that consumer to go to that website and click on that thing and find that address and drive down to that site and put something in a box. Obviously, we know that. We participated in probably over the last 10 years in designing the Oregon e-waste program. Prior to the legislature actually approving that program, I think we had two or three biennia of serious and extensive debates. We had an interim task force for a whole year and a half prior to that. I'm not sure I personally haven't been consulted or approached, but I know our folks up in Washington State have. So I haven't participated in any conversation here on the ground in Oregon yet as to how this would work and how it would interface with a very successful computer recycling e-waste program that we have on the ground. We do get concerned when, as was mentioned before, that the state would, quote, generate a no-sell list. I mean, in a way, a no-sell list is the ultimate nuclear option to say that because you didn't do something, we will pull your product off the shelves. And that's another high bar to think long and hard about, whether we want that, whether we think the importance of battery recycling is important enough to compel products to be yanked from shelves and not available to Oregon consumers. Again, kind of a thorny thing that we all need to wrestle with. And finally, on the money part, and again, DEQ can't really give you an idea until we all see the bill. I know in the e-waste program, that's totally paid for by industry to the tune of about $3 million a biennium right now. It funds positions. Part of the funding goes to positions at DEQ. I'm not sure where the self-funding. In the Washington bill, there are some fees that if you want to get approved as a recycler, you'd pay, I think, $5,000. Well, it's clearly not enough money to fund the DEQ responsibilities in this bill. So how that agency, I think it's always important when we put another burden on DEQ to run a program that we make sure that they have adequate financing stream to fund the FTE and do the work that they're required to do. So those are just a number of comments to raise today. We're all at the disadvantage of not being able to look at the language. We look forward when we do get the dash ones or twos or whatever, we will circulate them to our members nationally, compare them to the debate that's going on in Washington State, and respond back to you once we have a little more information.
Great. Thank you. Questions for this witness? All right. We're letting you off easy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Is there anyone else who'd wish to testify on this bill?
Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill 2938. Open a public hearing on HJM 7. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, HJM 7 urges Congress to increase the investment in Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and the Clean Water State Revolving Fund to upgrade and repair public water and wastewater systems.
Representative Dembo, would you like to kick us off?
Sure, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to stay up here to do that. Because I just want to make a few comments before the people who really know a lot about this bill can come up and speak to it. I first learned about this subject a few years ago. I was at an AFL-CIO conference convention, and a resolution came through calling for Congress to increase its investment in a loan program that was specifically designed for, well, particularly designed for rural communities and meeting their water needs. And, you know, learned just how, you know, there was not as much investment in there to really help all the Oregon communities. And I was really struck by that because the resolution really seemed to meet a number of goals that I thought a lot of people could sign on to. You know, the idea of creating jobs, obviously, and increasing public health and paying particular attention to our rural, often remote communities who don't have the wherewithal to borrow and issue bonds that would allow them to do these kinds of projects, and that, you know, it would be an initiative that would cross party lines and could bring environmentalists and trade unionists together, construction trade unionists. And so we decided to go ahead develop a memorial and reach out to members to see if there was interest in it. And as it turns out, as you can see, if you look at the bill, almost a third of the legislature has signed on to the bill in a very bipartisan way, people from all over the state. And so, you know, I'm really proud to bring this before you, and hopefully we can send this memorial out and get some action from our federal brothers and sisters. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And I'd like to call up Eva Ripito, Alana Guinea, and Tracy Retton, please. Whoever would like to go first can start.
Thank you, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Eva Ripito, and I am here to represent AFSCME Council 75 and as a member of the Apollo Alliance Steering Committee. So we are in support of the resolution. Oregon AFSCME's Environmental Caucus were the people who presented the resolution that Representative Dembro mentioned at the AFL conference. And John Mullis of the Building Trades told me it did pass unanimously. I wasn't there. I was getting married, so I don't know. Thank you. So yeah, we're supportive, and that's all. Oh, for the sake of clean water and the infrastructure for the clean water, that is why we're supportive.
Great, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. Lana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO. That resolution did, as Eva say, pass at our statewide membership convention. And I just want to highlight how important an issue like this is, that it can bring together really all parts of our membership, which is incredibly diverse. And beyond that, all parts of the Apollo Alliance, an organization that we are also a member of. For those of you who don't know what the Apollo Alliance is, it is a group of unions, environmental groups, small businesses who get together and look at areas where we all can find common ground and can find things that can help all of our memberships improve the state. So we look at things like energy creation in the state. We look at resolutions or memorials like this that can help bring investment to communities across our state. And I want to highlight the importance of this to communities that really are all across the state. This is one of those memorials that, with strong support from the legislature, really can help influence what happens with our federal delegation, and that's why we would encourage all of you to support it and to reach out to your colleagues to get as many names on this bill and as many votes for it as possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Spoon, and Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Breton, and I'm here today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm representing Oregon's 242 cities. And I think Representative Dembro for introducing this legislation. And thank you for hearing the bill today. We are in support of this memorial. And I do apologize if any of this information is slightly redundant from yesterday, because we did talk to the House Business or Transportation Economic Development Committee about the infrastructure needs that our cities are facing. And we recently did a poll this past fall, and we heard from 80 of our cities, representing about 67% of the incorporated population, to inventory the infrastructure projects that they identified in their communities that they needed to address. And it was interesting to note that it was, I believe, $944 million was needed for water and wastewater improvement projects for the cities who did respond to that survey. Nearly half of those projects identified were just simply to maintain their current and immediate needs for supplying drinking water to their communities. Other projects that they identified involved updating of their water meters, additional security measures, updating of some of the dilapidated infrastructure. I did note yesterday in the committee meeting, but the city of Port Orford noted that they are losing half of their treated water supply due to corroding pipes. The city of Reedport also identified a need for updating to their pump station, which serves their downtown business district. That station was originally constructed in the early 1970s and involves two wooden pump systems. And during times of heavy rainfall, the businesses in that area are sandbagging to keep the water out from their businesses. Reedport also identified a need for replacing other storm drain and sewer main on Winchester Avenue, which is one of their more heavily utilized streets. The infrastructure in that area has deteriorated and resulted in sinkholes in that area. KFAL, Klamath Falls alone, has identified over $117 million in needed water and wastewater infrastructure improvements. This is a huge need in our state. These two funds are critical and provide a very important financing resource for our many communities, and we thank you for hearing this bill today.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you all very much for your advocacy. We appreciate it. Call up Julia DeGraw and Brian Krieg, please. Ms. DeGraw, please.
For the record, my name is Julia DeGraw, and I'm the Northwest organizer with Food and Water Watch, and I want to thank Chair Bailey and the members of the committee for hosting this hearing today. Food and Water Watch is a national consumer advocacy group focused on protecting our food and water systems, and here in Oregon we have about 12,000 supporters. Drinking water and sewer systems are something many Oregonians and Americans often take for granted. And what many of us don't know is that the systems that provide us for these services are woefully underfunded from a national level, and in too many cases are falling apart. Oregon Food and Water Watch's national campaign to renew America's water seeks to establish a stable source of federal funding to improve our communities, or our country's drinking water and sewer systems. The funding under our Renew America's Water proposal would still go through the State Revolving Fund, which is the program so we're trying to get the federal government to fund so that our communities, especially our rural communities, can gain access to more affordable funding through this loan program. The campaign also aims to fix school water infrastructure, build environmentally friendly water and sewer systems, and promote public control of water services and create thousands of jobs. We support this measure, or this memorial, because it urges the United States Congress to reinvest in America's water. Since the 1980s, the federal government has decreased its funding to drinking water and clean water infrastructure almost 70%. And yet, these systems are aging out. Many of them were built at the turn of the century, and we also continue to improve regulations on our drinking water and sewer systems, and yet these systems are getting less and less support from the federal government. We estimated, and this data is getting a little bit, this is a little bit dated, so it might even be a larger number at this point, but the EPA estimated estimates that each year over the next 10 years, a funding gap of $22 billion exists between the level of funding needed to update and repair drinking water and wastewater systems in the country and how much money that actually, you know, is available through the state revolving funds or through the current funding through Congress that goes to the state revolving funds. So Food and Water Watch's proposed legislation would actually fully fill that gap and go really far in creating jobs and upgrading our systems so that people have access to safe water and sanitation. Here in Oregon specifically, drinking water and sewer infrastructure needs dramatically outpace the available funding. According to Oregon's 2010 project priority list for the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, the state's public water system needed $44 million to keep our water safe, and in 2010, they received about $13.6 million in federal funding, only enough to finance about 31% of what was needed. In 2010, the wastewater systems in Oregon needed $456 million to protect Oregon water quality and public health, and they only received $23 million in federal funding, enough to only cover about 5% of their costs. So as a result, even after state contributions, state revolving funds fell $455 million short of what was needed to maintain Oregon's water and sewer systems, leaving local governments to shoulder this burden. And as we know, that burden really falls hard on the rural communities who often can't afford to raise rates to do the kind of upgrades they need to do to maintain their systems. And 50% of Oregon's priority projects that got funding for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund were in communities that were of 5,000 people or less. So if those programs are being fully funded, that's a lot more money that can go to those programs, or if the state revolving funds were fully funded. Renew America's Water will not just provide universal access to water and an improved environment, it will also create hundreds of thousands of quality jobs at a time when our communities need it most. In Oregon, the unemployment rate is hovering around 8.4% right now, leaving 168,000 Oregonians unemployed. According to the National Utility Contractors Association, for every $1 billion on infrastructure, nearly 27,000 jobs are created. So fully addressing the state's annual water funding shortfall would generate over 12,000 employment opportunities, not only in the water sector, but through the local economies that benefit from this increased employment. So therefore, every federal dollar invested in infrastructure yields about $1.59 return for our state, which would be fantastic. We could also go far in hiring a significant portion of our unemployed population, since a lot of these jobs, the water and sewer infrastructure jobs, are typically filled locally, and investing now in our water and sewer systems can generate solid economic growth throughout Oregon. Our aging water infrastructure, it's not just about creating jobs. Our aging infrastructure also causes pollution issues with our local lakes and streams. And this is true across the state of Oregon as well. According to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2006 Water Quality Assessment Report, 67% of the state's river miles and 97% of its lakes and lake waters and 80% of the coastal shoreline assessed were impaired and too polluted to support their designated uses. Sewage overflows and stormwater runoff can also cause waters to be unfit for recreational use. Oregon has had 26 closures and advisories on beaches in 2008. In addition, analysis of beach monitoring data shows that 5% of samples in Oregon exceeded national health standards. In other words, the contamination could lead to disease and health problems. And also, leaks in aging pipes and losing water, even in parts of the country facing, is a major problem, especially in parts of the country that are facing water shortages. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, 1.7 trillion gallons of water are lost from distribution to consumers' taps across the country, an equivalent to 1 out of every 5 gallons of drinking water. And this was outlined earlier is a major problem in a lot of our communities where they're losing, the town of Cascade Locks is losing about 30% of their water through leaky pipes as well. And this is a problem through a lot of the rural areas of our state. Trying to wrap this up. So basically, clearly the need to reinvest in our public water system is great, and it will take all the support we can garner from groups, municipalities, local and state governments, and thousands of Americans or citizens demanding what they deserve, which is to get Congress to reinvest in our water systems. If passed, this memorial helps pave the way to transforming our water infrastructure from a neglected relic to the modernized system that our communities deserve. So thank you so much for the chance to testify on this memorial, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Mr. Krieg.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm here today. My name is Brian Krieg, and I'm here today to represent the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. We have about 200 members, mostly small businesses, located throughout the state of Oregon. We have about 3,000 people that we employ. We would like to be employing a few more than that. We have a bunch that aren't working at the moment. We have a lot of large projects in certain areas of the state, and that is helping us tremendously. But the measure in front of you is a great item for many things that you have heard today. And one of them for us is the fact it would take jobs into a lot of places where we're not working right now throughout the state. This would help everyone, everywhere, bring in tax dollars, urge your support, and pass the measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? We appreciate the great information and the advocacy. Thank you very much. Anybody else who'd like to testify on this memorial? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on HJM 7, and committee is adjourned.
All right. Awesome.